Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Barbara Dana. She is an actress. She's the author of several books, including two on Emily Dickinson, Wider Than the Sky, which is essays and meditations on the healing power of Emily Dickinson, and A Voice of Her Own, which is a novel imagining Emily Dickinson's life. And on Saturday, May 30th, she will be doing a reading and book signing at Garcia Street Books at 10:30 in the morning. And then she will be in Los Alamos at 1:30 in the afternoon at Ottawa Station. Welcome, Barbara, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm so glad to be here.
So how did you get interested in the life of Emily Dickinson? You immersed yourself in her life and in her poetry.
Well, I did, and I spent actually 10 years on this book, so I really had to care because it's a long time. Well, I think the main reason is the inner strength of her and the inner strength of a young woman. This book concentrates on her young life from the age of 9 to 24, going from childhood into adulthood, and the journey of keeping that young, spunky voice. She was very, very spunky as a kid and remained spunky internally. I mean, as she grew with a lot of struggles to hold on to her way of doing things, her destiny, her dream, very tough, but she did, and it's kind of tracks that journey, and I'm very interested in that. The book I did prior to that was a novel based on the young life of Joan of Arc, who is, you know, kind of the archetype of that, of a young girl having a strong inner sense of what's true for her, and all around her, no one seems to share that, but her and her struggles in being true to what that is. So I think that was a big thing that interested me in Emily. And above that, I don't know. I just really love her.
Let's talk about her life for a moment. She was born in 1830 in Amherst, Massachusetts. And she had, as you say, a spunky
child. It was Amherst,
child.
Massachusetts. Did you say Amherst?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry. I thought you said Emerson. She loved Emerson, but was born in Amherst.
Right, and she ended up living a very introverted and, as they say, kind of reclusive life. Tell us about her life and development.
Well, she was born in Amherst. Her father was a very respected lawyer in the community. He was in politics. He was in the House of Representatives in Washington for, I believe it was 1 year. He was in the state government, serving in Massachusetts, and he had a very successful law practice. She had a older brother, Austin, who is 2 years older, and a younger sister, Lavinia, 2 years younger. Her mother was, pretty much all we need to say about the mid-1800s in New England is that she was a wife, quote. And that was another, women really did nothing much but be the wife and helpmate to the husband and his home and nothing else, nothing in addition to that. And she was, her mother was, suffered depressions, anxieties. She was, had a lot of hypochondria. Her father was extremely remote and yet very dictatorial, so it was an interesting combination. He held the family very close. His way was the way things were to be done, but he wasn't there much, and even when he was there, he was kind of remote. So that was an interesting family dynamic.
So what was it like for somebody of so much passion, talent, and vision to grow up in 19th century New England where women didn't get to really express that?
It was horrendously hard. Now, I took it from, like, now, for me to have my own voice and be true to express a lot of the things that I want to do creatively is still been an issue for me, and I think it is for some women even today. But if we look back to the 1800s in Puritan New England, it was a huge difficult thing for her. She was very spunky as a kid, with a lot of girlfriends, boyfriends, parties, dances, sleigh rides, maple sugaring, very funny, and as very close to the girlfriends. And as she entered, she came back from Mount Holyoke, where she was in college for a year, Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, it was called at that time. Now it's Mount Holyoke College. She was beginning to feel that separation from her girlfriends, who were all taking the more traditional route of concentrating only on who they would marry, how soon they would marry, and if they could marry someone and be the wife of a missionary, that was really the best thing. And it was really all-consuming in those days, and that's all you did. There were very few women. There were some women writers then, but very, very few. It was not highly thought of. It began to be highly thought of that women be educated. That was starting, but not that they used it for anything. And her inner fire, like a volcano, was calling out to her to fulfill her destiny as she began to be aware of it in her childhood and later childhood. It grew and grew. And how was she going to pursue this in the face of it wasn't done? It just wasn't done. And her father was very against it.
And so, actually, I was wondering if you might want to read a poem or two. Probably many of our listeners know Emily Dickinson's work, and many of them don't. And so to give people a sense of the intensity and what would you call distilled nature of some of her work, I think would be wonderful. Do you have any favorites that you'd like to read?
Oh, wow. Well, picking them is hard. I better find my book. I know a lot of them by heart because I'm doing The Belle of Amherst, which is a play about her. There's a lot of her poetry in it, and I have to learn it all. I'm trying to think what I will pick.
Take your time, because I can edit this.
Okay. Oh, that's great to know. Okay. Well, here's one that hit me like a ton of bricks. I was going through a really difficult time in my life, and it was when I really got close to her was during this time. It was about 12 years ago, and things had been a certain way in my life. And for years and years and years, and that's the way I thought it would be. And suddenly, it was actually my marriage, my family life in that marriage broke apart. And that was something I never questioned. And suddenly, what I mostly thought was a given wasn't there. And it set me, it was a very tough time for me. And I couldn't really, for a while, feel anything. I mean, I didn't even know. I couldn't figure out why I should get up. I mean, it wasn't like, oh God, I can't get out of bed today. It was just like I just didn't see why. It didn't make sense to me. I was numb. And I didn't think that anyone understood me. And this poem, I read this poem, and it kind of cracked me open emotionally. To try to remember it by heart. I cautious scanned my little life. I winnowed what would fade from what would last till heads like mine should be a dreaming laid. I put the latter in a barn. The former blew away. I went one winter morning, and lo, my priceless hay was not upon the scaffold. Was not upon the beam, and from a thriving farmer, a cynic I became. Whether a thief did it, whether it was the wind, whether deities guiltless, my business is to find. And so I ransack. How is it, hearts, with thee? Art thou within the little barn love provided thee? And that just cracked me open, that somebody knew what I was going through, that someone had expected things to be a certain way, the one thing that they were surest of is suddenly gone.
Right, right. Well, there's a couple of things that speaks to, and one of them is the you edited this whole book on the healing power of Emily Dickinson's work.
Yes, and I wanted to mention, Mary Sharp, that I co-edited it. My wonderful
right.
co-editor is Cindy McKenzie, who is a Dickinson scholar from Canada. So we did that together, and we each also have essays in the book.
Right, and because the work, the Dickinson work, is so cognizant of pain and the abyss, and probably the word existential hadn't been coined yet, but
yeah.
that sense of this terrible nothingness, just simply knowing that somebody else understands that and can articulate it better than you can, is in itself kind of a healing power.
Tremendous. I mean, I don't know. I think it may be true for a lot of people, but for me, a big, big what made my pain and my difficult situation even worse was this knowledge, I would call it, that I was filled with, that I was alone, that nobody really knew what I was feeling. And I have such wonderful friends and family, and they would say, it's going to get better. You're stronger than you think. Time heals all these things. And they were, oh, I don't know if time by itself heals it, but it can help. They were actually right, but my feeling was that they were very sweet, they were being very, very supportive, but they didn't actually know what was going on with me, or they wouldn't say that. So I just felt alone. I didn't feel seen. And the fact that someone can articulate pain, not just to describe it intellectually, but to, in a way that you know they've been there right where you are. You know it. It just is a very, for me, was a very, very healing thing.
I think another really important point that you bring up in your work is the presence of death and pain seems to be more present in perhaps in the whole 19th century, perhaps in the whole era before, you know, painkillers and antidepressants and antibiotics and the many comforts that we take for granted. Pain was the norm, was the mainstream, was acknowledged, and she gave voice to it in a way that's kind of hard for us to do now, because at least in American culture, it's kind of expected that your life be good and nice.
Yes, I think that's a very interesting point. And it was not so true then. And death, I mean, we live with a lot of, God knows, death now. But for let's say Amherst in the 1800s, people were dropping like flies from tuberculosis, for instance, mainly, and a lot of things. Emily's house, her growing up house, from the age of 5 to 24, the ages that I center on in my book, her house was right on the town seminary, cemetery, bordered this cemetery. And outside her window every day would be burials and passive people that she knew, school friends, one after the next after the next. And to try and really make sense of that, she really did a lot of thinking, and it tapped a lot of knowledge inside her, maybe inside all of us deep, that she was sensitive enough not to cover over, of questions about death and the sense that we don't live forever, which is, there's a wonderful verse in her poem that inspired me. It's the last verse of a poem, and I'm forgetting the first line at the moment, but it's My sickness, was it loss or that ethereal gain one gathers measuring the grave, then measuring the sun? Which I find very inspiring. You know, a lot of times you'll go through an illness or a depression or whatever, and can come out of it stronger because you've allowed yourself, been able to go there and go through it, and it's more than appreciate the good. It's more of a just being in a place where you're not blotting out death.
We're talking to Barbara Dana about the life of Emily Dickinson. There's one that I memorized a while back that really doesn't have any hopefulness at all, but I love it. Can I say it?
Please.
It goes like this. The heart asks pleasure first, and then excuse from pain, and then those little anodynes that deaden suffering. And then to go to sleep, and then if it should be the will of its inquisitor, the privilege to die.
How about that?
There's no light at the end of that tunnel.
No. And it's not really, except that it is a graphic inner piercing of what we can feel sometimes. It's a graphic sense of what that feels like, and the sense that someone can feel that and still be alive and write about it.
Exactly.
Is to me also inspiring.
So you work with young people, you work with girls, and bring Emily Dickinson's work to them. You're doing something here in Santa Fe. You do stuff all over the place. What? Tell us about that work with young people.
Well, I'm very interested in this issue of young people maintaining their own voices, and I think it's a lot of it is personally because it's been hard for me to do, and something that's meant a lot to me to do. And I think it's a very tricky time, and I'm sure it is for boys as well as girls. I just have a personal experience with a girl going through it, and the time of the spunkiness and spirit of girls and the enthusiasm and all kinds of different things. And I think even today, that there's a real danger of that being deadened and a sense coming, trying to navigate adolescence and hold on to that and not just fall into, you know, well, how can I, you know, be like the other girls, or how can I marry the right person, or how can I be what that pretty enough, or how can I have the right figure, or how can I, all these things that can dampen the individuality of this girl. It's so tragic to me. And so I know there are workshops and groups around now that are feeling as I do about this and want to help to give girls, help girls with a sense of their self-esteem, a sense of their originality and enthusiasm and taking risks and appreciating themselves and their bodies. A lot of these things that actually Girls Incorporated kind of stresses. And I think girls need strong role models. I bet boys do too. I'm being a girl, having been a girl, now a woman, I think about that very strongly. And I think they need strong role models, which is why the book on Joan of Arc, I think, also sparked me. So I'm thinking these workshops, they're involved with exploring. There's several scenes in my book of Emily at this point in her adolescence and struggling with feeling different from the way her girlfriends are feeling and going, and feeling this need to express her originality and her, and be a writer and maybe not even get married. I mean, oh my God, that was a horrific thought in those days. And there's a couple of scenes, few scenes in the book that way, and a lot of the workshops will take these scenes and the girls will read different parts with me and with each other, and then it'll open it up for talks about what that brings up for them, and if if any of that and what of that is true for them or things that they might worry about and how they might like to deal with it. So, it's kind of a leaping off point.
I mean, it is a kind of an irony that this work, which is used and which you consciously use for exploration and healing and so on, Emily Dickinson didn't even share with anybody. It was all poems stuck on scraps of paper in a drawer.
Yes. She did share some of the poetry in letters. She was a prolific letter writer, and there's a huge volume of her letters, which is enormously helpful as research. I lived with those letters. I read them every day solidly for 2 years, and constantly off and on since, where she connected with friends and would often include a poem in those. But other than that, no, she sewed her poems into little hand-sewn booklets called fascicles, and she put them in the bottom drawer of her bureau. And she would, as you say, she had these scraps of paper during the day, and she'd have to do the things of helping to run the house and all the work, and then at 10 o'clock at night, she'd go up with these little scraps and put them in, you know, and write her poetry based on these little scraps and put it in the drawer.
So why didn't she become more public? I mean, was it really that impossible as a woman to be a public poet in the mid-19th century?
It wasn't impossible, but from my understanding of exploring the period, it was difficult. And there were not very many of them. And it was particularly difficult for Emily, not only in the culture, but in her family and her family dynamic with the father. I mean, he was an enormous impressive element of her life and very dictatorial. She was very tied to him. It was she would say, or did say, his heart was pure and terrible, and I think no other like it exists. It's very, you know, two-faceted, which is a tough thing to deal with. She was very tied to him and what he would want. He didn't want the daughters to get married. Never heard that he said that, but it was clear. And they didn't.
How odd. Well, I mean, when you think about Jane Austen, I mean, it's a different place, but, you know, don't all parents want to marry their daughters off?
No. I think most do. But, I must say for myself, I could relate to that because I don't, I think at the base, my father didn't want me to get married. I mean, I think he would like to have wanted it. But deep down, I think he wanted me to keep me as his little girl.
Right.
And I understand that. And Emily's father used to call her the best little girl in Amherst. And he really, you know, valued her as a little girl. But he didn't want the family to leave home. He didn't want her to have boyfriends and go out on dates and... He was very difficult about that. If she was out 30 seconds past the 9 o'clock curfew, he would come and get her. I don't think he wanted to share his daughters. It's sad, but it happened sometime.
So here you are immersed in the life of Emily Dickinson in a really different way than most people who study her are. Most people who study Emily Dickinson are academics. And there's a nice passage of how you go to these academic conferences and are kind of both intimidated and amazed at the amount of picayune scholarship on
yes.
You know, the use of the dash in her poetry.
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yeah, that was great. I went to met one scholar, the first meeting I went to, because I'm an actor and a fiction writer, and I've never even gone to college. I'm beginning to come out with that now and say it, but it's been a little bit, I'm a little bit embarrassed about that, but I'm self-educated. So I was intimidated, but I wanted their knowledge. I wanted to learn more about Dickinson from these other points of view, and I first woman I met there, I said, so what, you know, what are you doing with Dickinson? And she said, well, you know, I'm doing a book on the exploration of the meaning of the dash in Emily Dickinson's poetry between 1861 and 1862.
Heavens.
I mean, and I was like, oh, my God. And I said, she said, and also exploring the possibility that she may have written poetry earlier than we realize. And I said, because the first known poem that exists is one she wrote at 19. So I said, yeah, you know, I have the feeling that she wrote some things earlier. And the look on her face, anyway, the way I interpreted it was like, you have a feeling? You have a feeling? I mean, that's not, what value is that? We want to find out whether she did. It was just coming at Dickinson from just the study of her from different directions. And now I think we've all kind of come, myself and the others in the group, the Emily Dickinson International Society, great group of scholars and lovers of Dickinson. We've kind of, I think, come to the fact, or certainly I have, and maybe they always did, that we just come from study from different ways, you know, but it's the same journey.
Barbara Dana is an actress. She's the author of two books on Emily Dickinson. One is a novel, and one is a, she's actually co-editor of a book of essays called Wider Than the Sky, Essays and Meditations on the Healing Power of Emily Dickinson. That is a book that kind of runs some, I don't know what, in-between world between academia and people who buy books about healing.
Yes, it does, and that we did that on purpose. I was suggested by my colleague Cindy McKenzie, who is a Dickinson scholar and professor in Canada, and she had this idea for a book of essays about the healing power of Dickinson's poetry, because she had been helped very much by it, and she knew of other scholars, and she thought we met and we were talking. She mentioned it to me, and the fact that she had contact with the scholars who might offer essays on why her poetry might do this, and why in a scholarly manner and a literary manner what might be involved, and that I would have a lot of people that I could bring, actors, writers, painters, poets, who would approach it in a more sensory way. So it is really well balanced, I think. It's really interesting in that way. I think it turned out really, really well, I must say, that it has essays by psychologists. Marion Woodman from Canada has a brilliant, the writer and psychologist has a brilliant essay. Poets, Gregory Orr, painters, scholars, actors. And then we have a group of really well-known people who love her, who have short pieces all the way through. And it's it does bring a lot of different perspectives to the study of why her work might help in healing.
Barbara Dana will be at Garcia Street Books on Saturday, May 30th at 10:30 in the morning, and then she'll be in Los Alamos at Ottawa Station at 1:30 in the afternoon. Barbara Dana, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Please stay tuned to KSFR.